Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. The 2019 coronavirus has now spread to 71 countries and infected more than 92,000 people. This has, of course, affected travel plans for some in Illinois. Students at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois State University have been instructed to come home because of worries over the coronavirus in places like Italy and South Korea. And Bradley University in Peoria also notified students that they must return home from Rome, Florence, and Milan. Joining us now on the line is Nathan Thomas, VP of Student Affairs at Bradley University in Peoria. Nathan, welcome to The 21st.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And many of those students returning home will be traveling to the Peoria International Airport. Gene Olson is the Director of Airports for the Metropolitan Airport Authority of Peoria. He's with us now as well. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me also.
I'm going to start with Nathan. Why did you make the decision to have students at Bradley return home?
Well, our recommendation to our students specifically in Italy is that we recommend that they return. And it's really out of an abundance of caution for their well-being. And if you think about how potentially traumatic it could be if you were abroad, away from family and those networks that you have, of what that impact may be to the student. On top of, we've been in tremendous communication with the affiliate programs that our students are a part of, and they have either canceled those programs completely or provided online alternatives for our students. So there's abilities for them to complete their coursework in alternative manners than being presently face-to-face.
Nathan, how many students do you have abroad right now?
We have 36 students in 15 different countries at this point.
Gene, some of those students returning home will likely go through O'Hare or Dallas, but their final destination may be through the Peoria International Airport. We know that O'Hare has been screening passengers from some countries. How has your airport changed its processes?
Well, we haven't really changed anything directly. Our posture at this point is monitoring all the guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and making sure that, you know, that we are abreast of everything that's going on. But as far as changing any direct procedures or anything like that, we haven't been asked to do that, and there's no guidance out there suggesting that we do that. And in fact, it's kind of, you know, the opposite, because this is even on the CDC website, the way air is filtered through an airliner, it gets recirculated and filtered very frequently. So the chances of actually catching a COVID-19 infection while you're on a plane is pretty low. We do have hand sanitizers, dispensers scattered throughout the airport on both the public side and on the secured side. But that's not new. We've had that since before I came to work here in 2009.
So most of the guidance that you're looking to is Center for Disease Control. Are you looking also, does Illinois Department of Public Health weigh in on Illinois airports?
Not really. Most of our guidance along those lines comes from the County Health Department. We stay in very close contact with them. They participate in all of our emergency planning. We have good contacts with their staff. And just to give you an example, back when MERS was a thing a couple of years ago, there was a patient that traveled through O'Hare and went to, I don't think he even flew, I think he went by surface transportation to somewhere in north central Indiana. And the county health department, you know, they had traced that person back to a flight through O'Hare, and just because of the O'Hare connection, the county health department notified us of that patient. So, it's good communication and a good relationship that we have with them that keeps us apprised of what's going on.
Gene, you brought up MERS. Nathan, I'm wondering, has Bradley ever had to get students to return because of a similar outbreak like this?
I don't believe so, and I've been here at the university for a few years now. I mean, a lot of our preparation goes back to H1N1 about 10-plus years ago, and we're following, similar to Gene, a lot of our protocols that we've had in place for a number of years and just making sure that they're updated, but also in preparation for what is really an emerging type of guidance, and that we can be responsive as we may need to.
Gene, at the airport, what responsibility do you think airports that are smaller like yours have when it comes to preventing a potential pandemic like coronavirus? I mean, do you feel like you have enough resources from the county or the state?
Well, the resources that we do have are, you know, information resources, and I think that's very good. We're getting information when it becomes available. But in terms of other resources, there's zero. But I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. You know, there's not really a need at this point. All the international arrivals all go through gateway airports and are screened there. So I guess my question would be, resources to do what? Mm-hmm. Because we're not involved in screening passengers. We're not involved in screening visitors. Just the same way that we don't do that for influenza. I don't feel that there aren't any resources, but I don't know that we need them either, because it's all the screenings being done at the bigger gateway airports.
Gene, are you seeing passengers show signs of concern? I mean, are you seeing people come through the gates with face masks, more hand sanitizer, things that they're doing on their own?
It's hard to say whether I'm just noticing it more or whether it's an increased level, but, you see passengers all the time duck over to one of the hand sanitizer dispensers and get a little squirt of that stuff. You see people with, face masks, but not more than you normally would. There's always a certain amount of that. We have, because of kind of our travel patterns and the hubs that we connect to, we do see a significant percentage of our travelers are older folks, and those are the ones you tend to see more with masks, but no different than before the outbreak.
And Nathan, have you heard from the Bradley students or faculty who are abroad now? I mean, when are they expecting to arrive home?
Yeah, we've been in really good communication with our students who are abroad. And some of them have already returned. Others are awaiting flights that may return within the next couple of days. And so we've been, through our study abroad office, been in very consistent communication with them, not only on the alert levels within their countries, but what our recommendations are. And then they've been communicative back to us of what their travel plans are. So we have a pretty good tracking of where exactly our students are and when they're going to be where along their journeys back to.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. We've been speaking with Gene Olson, director of the Peoria International Airport, and Nathan Thomas, who is VP of Student Affairs at Bradley. Bradley, like many colleges around the state, has asked students to return home from countries where there have been a high number of coronavirus cases. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure.
I want to bring in another voice into the conversation here. Chris Brook is an assistant professor in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Chris, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
When we say coronavirus, it's not actually one virus. Can you walk us through some of the terminology and distinctions in terms of what we're talking about?
Right. So coronavirus is a broad family of viruses. In fact, lots of different animal species around the world. There are already several coronaviruses that regularly infect humans and sort of fall under the umbrella of common cold viruses. But then there are also some of these viruses that are, naturally infect animals but have gained the ability to move into humans and cause more severe disease. And so SARS coronavirus in 2003, as well as MERS coronavirus since 2012, and now SARS coronavirus 2.
What do we know about how the virus spreads?
Right, so it's almost certainly this virus is spreading via the respiratory route. So that means virus expelled by infected individuals, either by coughing, sneezing, or even normal breath. So virus via the air. It's also, there's a good chance that you can see transmission via contact. And so that means virus deposited on surfaces, door handles, elevator buttons, things like that. That then people touch with their hand and then touch their hand to their nose or their eyes or other mucosal surfaces.
I was just at a big box store and I saw up in the front they had all of the wipes, the sanitation, all of those in front. And then, you know, obviously we're starting to see some images of face masks and things like that. What would be the value of wearing a face mask if you're healthy or using like a Clorox wipes or something, antibacterial wipes around your home? Is that needed now?
Right. So let me talk about the face masks first. So the value of a face mask when you're healthy is zero. It's actually somewhat costly from a broader perspective. So the face masks that you buy in the store are not really going to protect you to any sufficient degree from respiratory viruses. And in fact, you know, they may have some efficacy when you're already sick of limiting the amount of virus that you're expelling, but certainly they're not going to protect you if you're healthy.
Why not?
And just because they don't actually fully block the access of virus within aerosols or respiratory droplets in the air from getting into your respiratory tract. They don't actually seal things off effectively. There are respirators that do that, but these aren't the sort of thing that you pick up at Bed Bath & Beyond. And a more critical issue is that that respirators and face masks are needed by frontline healthcare responders and other healthcare professionals. And we are very concerned about shortages and the availability of these masks. So, you know, healthy people in the community buying these up out of fear increases the chances that there won't be enough of these available for healthcare professionals or other people who are really at the forefront of responding to this virus and are thus at the greatest risk of contracting and transmitting the virus.
So it really does go back to the hand washing?
Right. So hand washing is critical, is the best thing you can do. The other sort of approach that's been shown to be effective in similar situations is what's called social distancing. So really just keeping your distance from other people. That minimizes the chances for, you know, transmission via coughing, sneezing, or breathing. And I think as this virus becomes more widespread in our communities, just minimizing the amount of time you spend around other people, especially in close contact, is one of the best tools that we have for limiting community spread.
And there's going to be some places that are really difficult to do that, places like airports. And we just heard that there's different preventative measures and some places aren't doing preventative things quite yet. Do you agree with what officials in airports have been doing across the country to prevent the spread of the virus? Is there anything else that they could or should be doing?
So, you know, to my understanding, they're following the directions of the Centers for Disease Control and potentially also the WHO, which are in line with each other. And that's absolutely what I would recommend. The Centers for Disease Control is the best resource and has the broadest, deepest amount of expertise in the subject. I would absolutely, their recommendations would be the gold standard.
How far from a vaccination do you think we are, Chris?
Right. So people are working very hard and very fast on this right now. That being said, it would probably be in the neighborhood of 12 months or more before we have a vaccine that is licensed to go to be used in a widespread fashion. We, as I understand it, groups including the National Institutes of Health are moving into what are called phase one clinical trials in the next 2 to 3 months. And what that does is basically take candidate vaccines that we think might work and test them in a limited subset of people to make sure that they're safe and that they're well tolerated.
We've gotten comfortable with the flu vaccine. I mean, in terms of you see it at grocery stores, you can get it at, you know, Walgreens or a CVS. If and when a vaccine for coronavirus is readily available, do you imagine it would be a similar thing or it would just be people among a vulnerable population who would want to make the appointment to get that?
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer for it because we don't really know how this virus is going to play out. It remains an open question whether it's going to, you know, spread and eventually die out, or whether it will show a pattern similar to what influenza pandemics have done in the past, where, you know, you have this initial pandemic where a lot of people get infected and sick, And then the virus sort of establishes itself in the human population. It becomes a much less severe, more seasonal influenza virus. And so I think it's, you know, it really depends on what this virus does over the next year or two, whether it disappears, whether it continues with the same sort of mortality and morbidity rates, or whether it maintains itself in the population and becomes something much less severe. And so I think based on that, you know, I would recommend following, again, the recommendations of the CDC and WHO when the time comes.
And just finally, since we've got a virologist on the line here, as you're making sense of this in your own personal world, we're inundated with images on social media and so forth, and from reputable news organizations as well. Where do you categorize this?
I would say that it certainly is at, if characterizing it as a pandemic is certainly a reasonable thing to do. And I expect that we're going to see case numbers and deaths in the United States increasing substantially as we gain the ability to actually test for this virus. I think right now we're actually, most places are unable to test for the virus, or if they are, the amount of testing is limited. So I think this is something we're going to be dealing with for a while. I don't think it's going to be catastrophic. I think a good example might be the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, but yeah, it's something to take seriously, that's for sure.
That's
and
Chris.
I'm certainly taking it seriously.
Thank you, Chris Brook, assistant professor in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.